his grandfather had transmitted to him had been on the horse too that night, and had been killed too, and time had stopped there and then for the seed, and nothing had happened in time since. Not even him. The wife returned before Sunday. It was hot. The old people said that it was the hottest spell which the town had ever known. She came to church that Sunday and took her seat on a bench at the back, alone. In the middle of the sermon, she sprang from the bench and began to scream, to shriek something toward the pulpit, shaking her hands toward the pulpit where her husband had ceased talking, leaning forward with his hands raised and stopped. Some people nearby tried to hold her, but she fought them, and they told Byron how she stood there in the aisle now, shrieking and shaking her hands at the pulpit where her husband leaned with his hands still raised and his wild face frozen in the shape of the thundering and allegorical period which he had not completed. They did not know whether she was shaking her hands at him or at God. Then he came down and approached, and she stopped fighting then, and he led her out, with the heads turning as they passed, until the superintendent told the organist to play. That afternoon the elders held a meeting behind locked doors. The people did not know what went on behind them, save that Hightower returned and entered the vestry room and closed the door behind him too. But the people did not know what had happened. They only knew that the church made up a sum to send the wife to an institution, a sanatorium, and that Hightower took her there and came back and preached the next Sunday as usual. The women, the neighbors, some of whom had not entered the parsonage in months, were kind to him, taking him dishes now and then, telling one another and their husbands what a mess the parsonage was in, and how the minister seemed to eat like an animal. Just when he got hungry, and just whatever he could find. Every 2 weeks he would go and visit his wife in the sanatorium, but he always returned after a day or so. And on Sunday, in the pulpit again, it was as though the whole thing had never happened. The people would ask about her health, curious and kind, and he would thank them. Then Sunday he would be again in the pulpit, with his wild hands and his wild, rapt, eager voice in which, like phantoms, God and salvation and the galloping horses and his dead grandfather thundered, while below him the elders sat, and the congregation, puzzled and outraged. In the fall the wife came home. She looked better. She had put on a little flesh. She had changed more than that, even. Perhaps it was that she seemed chastened now. Awake, anyway. Anyhow, she was now like the ladies had wanted her to be all the time, as they believed that the minister's wife should be. She attended church and prayer meeting regularly, and the ladies called upon her, and she called upon them, sitting quiet and humble, even in her own house, while they told her how to run it and what to wear and what to make her husband eat. It might even be said that they forgave her. No crime or transgression had been actually named, and no penance had been actually set. But the town did not believe that the ladies had forgot those previous mysterious trips, with Memphis as their destination, and for that purpose regarding which all had the same conviction, though none ever put it into words, spoke it aloud, since the town believed that good women don't forget things easily, good or bad, lest the taste and savor of forgiveness die from the palate of conscience. Because the town believed that the ladies knew the truth. Since it believed that bad women can be fooled by badness, since they have to spend some of their time not being suspicious. But that no good woman can be fooled by it because by being good herself, she does not need to worry any more about hers or anybody else's goodness. Hence, she has plenty of time to smell out sin. That was why they believed that good can fool her almost any time into believing that it is evil. But that evil itself can never fool her. So when after 4 or 5 months the wife went away again on a visit and the husband said again that she had gone to visit her people, the town believed that this time even he was not fooled. Anyway, she came back and he went on preaching every Sunday like nothing had happened, making his calls on the people and the sick and talking about the church. But the wife did not come to church anymore, and soon the ladies stopped calling on her, going to the parsonage at all. And even the neighbors on either side would no longer see her about the house. And soon it was as though she were not there, as though everyone had agreed that she was not there, that the minister did not even have a wife. And he preaching to them every Sunday, not even telling them now that she had gone to visit her people. Maybe he was glad of that, the town thought. Maybe he was glad to not have to lie anymore. So nobody saw her when she got on the train that Friday. Or maybe it was Saturday, the day itself. It was Sunday morning's paper which they saw, telling how she had jumped or fallen from a hotel window in Memphis Saturday night and was dead. There had been a man in the room with her. He was arrested. He was drunk. They were registered as man and wife under a fictitious name. The police found her rightful name where she had written it herself on a piece of paper and then torn it up and thrown it into the wastebasket. The papers printed it with the story. Wife of the Reverend Gail Hightower of Jefferson, Mississippi. And the story told how the paper telephoned to the husband at 2 a.m. and how the husband said that he had nothing to say. And when they reached the church that Sunday morning, the yard was full of Memphis reporters taking pictures of the church and the parsonage. Then Hightower came. The reporters tried to stop him, but he walked right through them and into the church and up into the pulpit. The old ladies and some of the old men were already in the church, horrified and outraged, not so much about the Memphis business as about the presence of the reporters. But when Hightower came in and actually went up into the pulpit, they forgot about the reporters even. The ladies got up first and began to leave. Then the men got up too, and then the church was empty, save for the minister in the pulpit, leaning a little forward, with the book open and his hands propped on either side of it, and his head not bowed either, and the Memphis reporters. They had followed him into the church, sitting in a line in the rear pew. They said he was not watching his congregation leaving. He was not looking at anything. They told Byron about it, about how at last the minister closed the book carefully and came down into the empty church and walked up the aisle without once looking at the row of reporters, like the congregation had done, and went out the door. There were some photographers waiting out in front with the cameras all set up and their heads under the black cloths. The minister had evidently expected this, because he emerged from the church with an open hymn book held before his face. But the cameramen had evidently expected that, too, because they fooled him. Very likely he was not used to it and so was easily fooled, they told Byron. One of the cameramen had his machine set up to one side, and the minister did not see that one at all, or until too late. He was keeping his face concealed from the one in front, and next day when the picture came out in the paper, it had been taken from the side, with the minister in the middle of a step, holding the hymn book before his face. And behind the book, his lips were drawn back as though he were smiling. But his teeth were tight together and his face looked like the face of Satan in the old prints. The next day he brought his wife home and buried her. The town came to the ceremony. It was not a funeral. He did not take the body to the church at all. He took it straight to the cemetery and he was preparing to read from the book himself when another minister came forward and took it from his hand. A lot of the people, the younger ones, remained after he and the others had gone, looking at the grave. Then even the members of the other churches knew that his own had asked him to resign and that he refused. The next Sunday, a lot of them from the other churches came to his church to see what would happen. He came and entered the church. The congregation as one rose and walked out, leaving the minister and those from the other churches who would come as though to a show. So he preached to them, as he had always preached, with that rapt fury which they had considered sacrilege and which those from the other churches believed to be out-and-out insanity. He would not resign. The elders asked the church board to recall him. But after the story, the pictures in the papers and all, no other town would have him either. There was nothing against him personally, they all insisted. He was just unlucky. He was just born unlucky. So the people quit coming to the church at all, even the ones from the other churches who had come out of curiosity for a time. He was no longer even a show now. He was now only an outrage. But he would reach the church at the old hour each Sunday morning and go to the pulpit, and the congregation would rise and leave, and the loafers and such would gather along the street outside and listen to him preaching and praying in the empty church. And the Sunday after that, when he arrived, the door was locked, and the loafers watched him try the door and then desist and stand there with his face still not bowed, with the street lined with men who never went to church anyway, and little boys who did not know exactly what it was, but that it was something, stopping and looking with still round eyes at the man standing quite motionless before the locked door. The next day the town heard how he had gone to the elders and resigned his pulpit for the good of the church. Then the town was sorry with being glad, as people sometimes are sorry for those whom they have at last forced to do as they wanted them to. They thought, of course, that he would go away now, and the church made up a collection for him to go away on and settle somewhere else. Then he refused to leave the town. They told Byron of the consternation, the more than outrage, when they learned that he had bought the little house on the back street where he now lives and has lived ever since. And the elders held another meeting because they said that they had given him the money to go away on, and when he spent it for something else, he had accepted the money under false pretenses. They went to him and told him so. He asked them to excuse him. He returned to the room with the sum which had been given him, to the exact penny and in the exact denominations, and insisted that they take it back. But they refused, and he would not tell where he had got the money to buy the house with. So by the next day, they told Byron, there were some who said that he had insured his wife's life and then paid someone to murder her. But everyone knew that this was not so, including the ones who told and repeated it, and the ones who listened when it was told. But he would not leave the town. Then one day they saw the little sign which he had made and painted himself and set in his front yard, and they knew that he meant to stay. He still kept the cook, a Negro woman. He had had her all the time. But they told Byron how as soon as his wife was dead, the people seemed to realize all at once that the Negro was a woman, that he had that Negro woman in the house alone with him all day, and how the wife was hardly cold in the shameful grave before the whispering began, about how he had made his wife go bad and commit suicide because he was not a natural husband, a natural man, and that the Negro woman was the reason. And that's all it took, all that was lacking. Byron listened quietly, thinking to himself how people everywhere are about the same, but that it did seem that in a small town, where evil is harder to accomplish, where opportunities for privacy are scarcer, that people can invent more of it in other people's names. Because that was all it required. That idea, that single idle word blown from mind to mind. One day the cook quit. They heard how one night a party of carelessly masked men went to the minister's house and ordered him to fire her. Then they heard how the next day the woman told that she quit herself because her employer asked her to do something which she said was against God and nature. And it was said that some masked men had scared her into quitting because she was what is known as a high brown, and it was known that there were two or three men in the town who would object to her doing whatever it was which she considered contrary to God and nature, since, as some of the younger men said, if a nigger woman considered it against God and nature, it must be pretty bad. Anyway, the minister couldn't, or didn't, get another woman cook. Possibly the men scared all the other Negro women in town that same night. So he did his own cooking for a while, until they heard one day that he had a Negro man to cook for him. And that finished him, sure enough. Because that evening some men, not masked either, took the Negro man out and whipped him. And when Hightower waked the next morning, his study window was broken, and on the floor lay a brick with a note tied to it, commanding him to get out of town by sunset and signed KKK. And he did not go. And on the second morning, a man found him in the woods about a mile from town. He had been tied to a tree and beaten unconscious. He refused to tell who had done it. The town knew that that was wrong, and some of the men came to him and tried again to persuade him to leave Jefferson for his own good, telling him that next time they might kill him. But he refused to leave. He would not even talk about the beating, even when they offered to prosecute the men who had done it. But he would do neither. He would neither tell nor depart. Then all of a sudden the whole thing seemed to blow away, like an evil wind. It was as though the town realized at last that he would be a part of its life until he died, and that they might as well become reconciled. As though, Byron thought, the entire affair had been a lot of people performing a play, and that now and at last they had all played out the parts which had been allotted them, and now they could live quietly with one another. They let the minister alone. They would see him working in the yard or the garden, and on the street and in the stores with a small basket on his arm, and they would speak to him. They knew that he did his own cooking and housework, and after a while the neighbors began to send him dishes again, though they were the sort of dishes which they would have sent to a poor mill family. But it was food, and well meant. Because, as Byron thought, people forget a lot in 20 years. Why, he thinks, I don't reckon there is anybody in Jefferson that knows that he sits in that window from sundown to full dark every day that comes, except me, or what the inside of that house looks like. And they don't even know that I know, or likely they'd take us both out and whip us again, since folks don't seem to forget much longer than they remember. Because there is one other thing which came into Byron's own knowledge and observation in his own time since he came to Jefferson to live. Hightower read a great deal. That is, Byron had examined with a kind of musing and respectful consternation the books which lined the study walls. Books of religion and history and science of whose very existence Byron had never heard. One day about 4 years ago, a Negro man came running up to the minister's house from his cabin on the edge of town immediately behind it, and said that his wife was at childbed. Hightower had no telephone, and he told the Negro to run next door and call a doctor. He watched the Negro go to the gate of the next house. But instead of entering, the Negro stood there for a time and then went on up the street toward town, walking. Hightower knew that the man would walk all the way to town and then spend probably 30 minutes more getting in touch with the doctor, in his fumbling and timeless Negro fashion, instead of asking some white woman to telephone for him. Then he went to his kitchen door, and he could hear the woman in the not-so-distant cabin, wailing. He waited no longer. He ran down to the cabin and found that the woman had got out of bed, for what reason he never learned, and she was now on her hands and knees on the floor, trying to get back into the bed, screaming and wailing. He got her back into the bed and told her to lie still, frightened her into obeying him, and ran back to his house and took one of the books from the study shelf and got his razor and some cord and ran back to the cabin and delivered the child. But it was already dead. The doctor, when arrived, said that she had doubtless injured it when she left the bed where Hightower found her. He also approved of Hightower's work, and the husband was satisfied too. But it was just too close to that other business, Byron thought, even despite the 15 years between them. Because within 2 days there were those who said that the child was Hightower's, and that he had let it die deliberately. But Byron believed that even the ones who said this did not believe it. He believed that the town had had the habit of saying things about the disgraced minister which they did not believe themselves, for too long a time to break themselves of it. Because always, he thinks, when anything gets to be a habit, it also manages to get a right good distance away from truth and fact. And he remembers one evening when he and Hightower were talking together, and Hightower said, "They are good people. They must believe what they must believe, especially as it was I who was at one time both master and servant of their believing. And so it is not for me to outrage their believing, nor for Byron Bunch to say that they are wrong. Because all that any man can hope for is to be permitted to live quietly among his fellows." That was soon after Byron had heard the story. Shortly after the evening visits to Hightower's study began, and Byron still wondered why the other remained in Jefferson, almost within sight of, and within hearing of, the church which had disowned and expelled him. One evening, Byron asked him, "Why do you spend your Saturday afternoons working at the mill while other men are taking pleasure downtown?" Hightower said. "I don't know," Byron said. "I reckon that's just my life." "And I reckon this is just my life, too," the other said. "But I know now why it is," Byron thinks. "It is because a fellow is more afraid of the trouble he might have than he ever is of the trouble he's already got. He'll cling to trouble he's used to before he'll risk a change." Yes. A man will talk about how he'd like to escape from living folks. But it's the dead folks that do him the damage. It's the dead ones that lay quiet in one place and don't try to hold him, that he can't escape from. They have thundered past now and crashed silently on into the dusk. Night has fully come. Yet he still sits at the study window, the room still dark behind him. The street lamp at the corner flickers and glares so that the bitten shadows of the unwinded maples seem to toss faintly upon the August darkness. From a distance, quite faint though quite clear, he can hear the sonorous waves of massed voices from the church, a sound at once austere and rich, abject and proud, swelling and falling in the quiet summer darkness like a harmonic tide. Then he sees a man approaching along the street. On a weak night he would have recognized the figure, the shape, the carriage and gait. But on Sunday evening, and with the echo of the phantom hooves still crashing soundlessly in the dusk-filled study, he watches quietly the puny, unhorsed figure moving with that precarious and meretricious cleverness of animals balanced on their hinder legs. That cleverness of which the man-animal is so fatuously proud and which constantly betrays him by means of natural laws like gravity and ice, and by the very extraneous objects which he has himself invented, like motor cars and furniture in the dark, and the very refuse of his own eating left upon floor or pavement. And he thinks quietly how right the ancients were in making the horse an attribute and symbol of warriors and kings, when he sees the man in the street pass the low sign and turn into his gate and approach the house. He sits forward then, watching the man come up the dark walk toward the dark door. He hears the man stumble heavily at the dark bottom step. "Byron Bunch," he says, "in town on Sunday night. Byron Bunch in Town on Sunday. Chapter 4. They sit facing one another across the desk. The study is lighted now by a green-shaded reading lamp sitting upon the desk. Hightower sits behind it in an ancient swivel chair, Byron in a straight chair opposite. Both their faces are just without the direct downward pool of light from the shaded lamp. Through the open window, the sound of singing from the distant church comes. Byron talks in a flat, level voice. It was a strange thing. I thought that if there ever was a place where a man would be where the chance to do harm could not have found him, it would have been out there at the mill on a Saturday evening. And with the house burning, too, right in my face, you might say. It was like all the time I was eating dinner and I would look up now and then and see that smoke and I would think, well, I won't see a soul out here this evening anyway. I ain't going to be interrupted this evening at least. And then I looked up and there she was, with her face all fixed for smiling and with her mouth all fixed to say his name, when she saw that I wasn't him. And I never knowed any better than to blab the whole thing. He grimaces faintly. It is not a smile. His upper lip just lifts momentarily, the movement, even the surface wrinkling, traveling no further and vanishing almost at once. I never even suspicioned then that what I didn't know was not the worst of it. It must have been a strange thing that could keep Byron Bunch in Jefferson over Sunday, Hightower says. But she was looking for him, and you helped her to find him. Wasn't what you did what she wanted? What she had come all the way from Alabama to find? I reckon I told her all right. I reckon it ain't any question about that. With her watching me. Sitting there, swole-bellied, watching me with them eyes that a man could not have lied to if he had wanted. And me blabbing on, with that smoke right yonder in plain sight like it was put there to warn me, to make me watch my mouth, only I never had the sense to see it. Oh, Hightower says, the house that burned yesterday. But I don't see any connection between... Whose house was it? I saw the smoke myself, and I asked a passing Negro, but he didn't know. That old Burden house, Byron says. He looks at the other. They look at one another. Hightower is a tall man, and he was thin once. But he is not thin now. His skin is the color of flour sacking, and his upper body in shape is like a loosely filled sack falling from his gaunt shoulders of its own weight upon his lap. Then Byron says, "You ain't heard yet." The other watches him. He says in a musing tone, "That would be for me to do, too. To tell on 2 days to two folks something they ain't going to want to hear and that they hadn't ought to have to hear at all." "What is this that you think I will not want to hear? What is it that I have not heard?" "Not the fire," Byron says. "They got out of the fire all right." "They? I understood that Miss Burden lived there alone." Again Byron looks at the other for a moment. But Hightower's face is merely grave and interested. "Brown and Christmas," Byron says. Still Hightower's face does not change in expression. "You ain't heard that even," Byron says. "They lived out there."
"Lived out there? They boarded in the house?"
"No. In a old nigger cabin in the back. Christmas fixed it up 3 years ago. He's been living in it ever since, with folks wondering where he slept at night. Then when him and Brown set up together, he took Brown in with him."
"Oh," Hightower said. "But I don't see... If they were comfortable... And Miss Burden didn't...
I reckon they got along. They were selling whiskey, using that old place for a headquarters. A blind.
I don't reckon she knew that, about the whiskey. Leastways, folks don't know if she ever knew or not. They say that Christmas started it by himself 3 years ago, just selling to a few regular customers that didn't even know one another. But when he took Brown in with him, I reckon Brown wanted to spread out. Selling it by the half a pint out of his shirt bosom in any alley and to anybody. Selling what he never drunk, that is. And I reckon the way they got the whiskey they sold would not have stood much looking into. Because about 2 weeks after Brown quit out at the mill and taken to riding around in that new car for his steady work, he was downtown drunk one Saturday night and bragging to a crowd in the barbershop something about him and Christmas in Memphis one night. Or on a road close to Memphis. Something about them and that new car hid in the bushes and Christmas with a pistol. And a lot more about a truck and 100 gallons of something until Christmas come in quick and walked up to him and jerked him out of the chair. And Christmas saying in that quiet voice of his, that ain't pleasant and ain't mad either, "You ought to be careful about drinking so much of this Jefferson hair tonic. It's gone to your head. First thing you know, you'll have a hair lip." Holding Brown up, he was, with one hand and slapping his face with the other. They didn't look like hard licks. But the folks could see the red even through Brown's whiskers when Christmas's hand would come away between licks. "You come out and get some fresh air," Christmas says. "You're keeping these folks from working." He muses. He speaks again. And there she was, sitting there on them staves, watching me and me blabbing the whole thing to her, and her watching me. And then she says, "Did he have a little white scar right here by his mouth?" "And Brown is the man," Hightower says. He sits motionless, watching Byron with a sort of quiet astonishment. There is nothing militant in it. Nothing of outraged morality. It is as though he were listening to the doings of people of a different race. Her husband a bootlegger. Well, well, well. Yet Byron can see in the other's face something latent, about to wake, of which Hightower himself is unaware, as if something inside the man were trying to warn or prepare him. But Byron thinks that this is just the reflection of what he himself already knows and is about to tell. "And so I had already told her before I knew it. And I could have bit my tongue in two, even then, even when I thought that that was all." He is not looking at the other now. Through the window, faint yet clear, the blended organ and voices come from the distant church across the still evening. "I wonder if he hears it, too," Byron thinks. "Or maybe he has listened to it so much and so long that he don't even hear it anymore. Don't even need to not listen." And she sat there all the evening while I worked, and the smoke dying away at last, and me trying to think what to tell her and what to do. She wanted to go right on out there, for me to tell her the way. When I told her it was 2 miles, she just kind of smiled like I was a child or something. "I done come all the way from Alabama," she said. "I reckon I ain't going to worry about 2 miles more." And then I told her. His voice ceases. He appears to contemplate the floor at his feet. He looks up. "I lied, I reckon. Only in a way, it was not a lie. It was because I knowed there would be folks out there watching the fire, and her coming up, trying to find him. I didn't know myself then, the other. The rest of it. The worst of it. So I told her that he was busy at a job he had, and that the best time to find him would be downtown after 6 o'clock. And that was the truth. Because I reckon he does call it work. Carrying all them cold little bottles naked against his chest, and if he ever was away from the square, it was just because he was a little behind in getting back or had just stepped into an alley for a minute. So I persuaded her to wait, and she sat there, and I went on working, trying to decide what to do. When I think now how worried I was on what little I knowed, now when I know the rest of it, it don't seem like I had anything then to worry me at all. All day I have been thinking how easy it would be if I could just turn back to yesterday and not have any more to worry me than I had then.
I still cannot see what you have to worry about, Hightower says. It is not your fault that the man is what he is or she what she is. You did what you could. All that any stranger could be expected to do. Unless... His voice ceases also. Then it dies away on that inflection, as if idle thinking had become speculation and then something like concern. Opposite him, Byron sits without moving, his face lowered and grave. And opposite Byron, Hightower does not yet think love. He remembers only that Byron is still young and has led a life of celibacy and hard labor, and that by Byron's telling, the woman whom he has never seen possesses some disturbing quality at least, even though Byron still believes that it is only pity. So he watches Byron now with a certain narrowness, neither cold nor warm, while Byron continues in that flat voice about how at 6 o'clock he had still decided on nothing. That when he and Lena reached the square, he was still undecided. And now there begins to come into Hightower's puzzled expression a quality of shrinking and foreboding as Byron talks quietly, telling about how he decided after they reached the square to take Lena on to Mrs. Beard's. And Byron talking quietly, thinking, remembering. It was like something gone through the air, the evening, making the familiar faces of men appear strange, and he, who had not yet heard, without having to know that something had happened which made of the former dilemma of his innocence a matter for children, so that he knew before he knew what had happened that Lena must not hear about it. He did not even have to be told in words that he had surely found the lost Lucas Birch. It seemed to him now that only the crassest fatuousness and imbecility should have kept him unaware. It seemed to him that fate, circumstance, had set a warning in the sky all day long in that pillar of yellow smoke, and he too stupid to read it. And so he would not let them tell. The men whom they passed, the air that blew upon them full of it, lest she hear too. Perhaps he knew at the time that she would have to know, hear it sooner or later, that in a way it was her right to know. It just seemed to him that if he could only get her across the square and into a house, his responsibility would be discharged. Not responsibility for the evil to which he held himself for no other reason than that of having spent the afternoon with her while it was happening, having been chosen by circumstance to represent Jefferson to her who had come afoot and without money for 30 days in order to reach there. He did not hope nor intend to avoid that responsibility. It was just to give himself and her time to be shocked and surprised. He tells it quietly, fumbling, his face lowered in his flat, inflectionless voice, while across the desk, Hightower watches him with that expression of shrinking and denial. They reached the boarding house at last and entered it. It was as though she felt foreboding too, watching him as they stood in the hall, speaking for the first time.
"What is it them men were trying to tell you? What is it about that burned house?"
"It wasn't anything," he said, his voice sounding dry and light to him. "Just something about Miss Burden got hurt in the fire."
"How got hurt? How bad hurt?"
"I reckon not bad. Maybe not hurt at all. Just folks talking like as not. Like they will." He could not look at her, meet her eyes at all. But he could feel her watching him, and he seemed to hear a myriad sounds. Voices.
the hushed, tense voices about the town, about the square through which he had hurried her, where men met among the safe and familiar lights, telling it. The house, too, seemed filled with familiar sounds, but mostly with inertia. A terrible procrastination as he gazed down the dim hall, thinking, "Why don't she come on? Why don't she come on?" Then Mrs. Beard did come. A comfortable woman, with red arms and untidy grayish hair. "This here is Miss Birch," he said. His expression was almost a glare. Importunate, urgent. "She just got to town from Alabama. She is looking to meet her husband here. He ain't come yet. So I brought her here where she can rest some before she gets mixed up in the excitement of town. She ain't been in town or talked to anybody yet, and so I thought maybe you could fix her up a place to get rested some before she has to hear talking and..." His voice ceased, died, recapitulant, urgent, importunate. Then he believed that she had got his meaning. Later he knew that it was not because of his asking that she refrained from telling what he knew that she had also heard, but because she had already noticed the pregnancy and that she would have kept the matter hidden anyway. She looked at Lena once, completely, as strange women had been doing for 4 weeks now. "How long does she aim to stay?" Mrs. Beard said. "Just a night or two," Byron said. "Maybe just tonight. She's looking to meet her husband here. She just got in, and she ain't had time to ask or inquire." His voice was still recapitulant, meaningful. Mrs. Beard watched him now. He thought that she was still trying to get his meaning. But what she was doing was watching him grope, believing, or about to believe, that his fumbling had a different reason and meaning. Then she looked at Lena again. Her eyes were not exactly cold, but they were not warm. "I reckon she ain't got any business trying to go anywhere right now," she said. "That's what I thought," Byron said quickly, eagerly. "With all the talk and excitement she might have to listen to, after not hearing no talk and excitement. If you were crowded tonight, I thought she might have my room." "Yes," Mrs. Beard said immediately. "You'll be taking out in a few minutes anyway. You want her to have your room until you get back Monday morning?" "I ain't going tonight," Byron said. He did not look away. "I won't be able to go this time." He looked straight into cold, already disbelieving eyes, watching her in turn trying to read his own, believing that she read what was there instead of what she believed was there. They say that it is the practiced liar who can deceive. But so often the practiced and chronic liar deceives only himself. It is the man who all his life has been self-convicted of veracity whose lies find quickest credence. "Oh," Mrs. Beard said. She looked at Lena again. "Ain't she got any acquaintances in Jefferson?" "She don't know nobody here," Byron said. "Not this side of Alabama. Likely Mr. Birch will show up in the morning." "Oh," Mrs. Beard said. "Where are you going to sleep?" But she did not wait for an answer. "I reckon I can fix her up a cot in my room for tonight, if she won't object to that." "That'll be fine," Byron said. "It'll be fine." When the supper bell rang, he was all prepared. He had found a chance to speak to Mrs. Beard. He had spent more time in inventing that lie than any yet. And then it was not necessary. That which he was trying to shield was its own protection. "Them men will be talking about it at the table," Mrs. Beard said. "I reckon a woman in her shape, and having to find a husband named Birch at the same time," she thought with dry irony, "ain't got no business listening to any more of man's devilment. You bring her in later, after they have all et." which Byron did. Lena ate heartily again, with that grave and hearty decorum, almost going to sleep in her plate before she had finished.
"It's right tiring, traveling is," she explained.
"You go set in the parlor and I'll fix your cot," Mrs. Beard said.
"I'd like to help," Lena said.
But even Byron could see that she would not, that she was dead for sleep. "You go set in the parlor," Mrs. Beard said. "I reckon Mr. Bunch won't mind keeping you company for a minute or two."
"I didn't dare leave her alone," Byron says.
Beyond the desk, Hightower has not moved.
And there we was settin', at the very time when it was all coming out downtown at the sheriff's office, at the very time when Brown was telling it all, about him and Christmas and the whiskey and all. Only the whiskey wasn't much news to folks, not since he had took Brown for a partner. I reckon the only thing folks wondered about was why Christmas ever took up with Brown. Maybe it was because like not only finds like. It can't even escape from being found by its like. Even when it's just like in one thing. Because even them too, with the same like, was different. Christmas dared the law to make money, and Brown dared the law because he never even had sense enough to know he was doing it. Like that night in the barber shop, and him drunk and talking loud until Christmas kind of run in and dragged him out. And Mr. Maxey said, "What do you reckon that was he pretty near told on himself and that other one?" And Captain McClendon said, "I don't reckon about it at all." And Mr. Maxey said, "Do you reckon they was actually holding up somebody else's liquor truck?" And McClendon said, "Would it surprise you to hear that that fella Christmas hadn't done no worse than that in his life?" That's what Brown was telling last night. But everybody knew about that. They had been saying for a good while that somebody ought to tell Miss Burden. But I reckon there wasn't anybody that wanted to go out there and tell her, because nobody knowed what was going to happen then. I reckon there are folks born here that never even saw her. I don't reckon I'd want her to go out there to that old house where nobody ever saw her, unless maybe it was folks in a passing wagon that would see her now and then standing in the yard in a dress and sunbonnet that some nigger women I know wouldn't have wore for its shape and how it made her look. Or maybe she already knew it. Being a Yankee and all, maybe she didn't mind. And then couldn't nobody have known what was going to happen. And so I didn't dare leave her alone until she was in bed. I aimed to come out and see you last night right away. But I never dared to leave her. Them other boarders was passing up and down the hall, and I didn't know when one of them would take a notion to come in and start talking about it and tell the whole thing. I could already hear them talking about it on the porch, and her still watching me with her face all fixed to ask me again about that fire. And so I didn't dare leave her. And we was sitting there in the parlor, and she couldn't hardly keep her eyes open then, and me telling her how I would find him for her all right, only I wanted to come and talk to a preacher I knowed that could help her to get in touch with him. And her sitting there with her eyes closed while I was telling her, not knowing that I knew that her and that fellow wasn't married yet. She thought she had fooled everybody. And she asked me what kind of a man it was that I am to tell about her too, and I told her, and her sitting there with her eyes closed, so that at last I said, "You ain't heard a word I've been saying." And she kind of roused up, but without opening her eyes, and said, "Can he still marry folks?" And I said, "What? Can he what?" And she said, "Is he still enough of a preacher to marry folks?" Hightower has not moved. He sits erect behind the desk, his forearms parallel upon the armrests of the chair. He wears neither collar nor coat. His face is at once gaunt and flabby. It is as though there were two faces, one imposed upon the other, looking out from beneath the pale, bald skull surrounded by a fringe of gray hair, from behind the twin, motionless glares of his spectacles. That part of his torso visible above the desk is shapeless, almost monstrous, with a soft and sedentary obesity. He sits rigid. On his face now, that expression of denial and flight has become definite.
Byron, he says. Byron, what is this you are telling me?
Byron ceases. He looks quietly at the other, with an expression of commiseration and pity.
I knowed you had not heard yet. I knowed it would be for me to tell you.
They look at one another.
What is it I haven't heard yet?
About Christmas. About yesterday and Christmas. Christmas is part nigger. About him and Brown and yesterday.
Part Negro, Hightower says.
His voice sounds light, trivial, like a thistle bloom falling into silence without a sound, without any weight. He does not move. For a moment longer, he does not move. Then there seems to come over his whole body, as if its parts were mobile, like face features, that shrinking and denial, and Byron sees that the still, flaccid, big face is suddenly slick with sweat. But his voice is light and calm.
What about Christmas and Brown and yesterday, he says.
The sound of music from the distant church has long since ceased. Now there is no sound in the room save the steady shrilling of insects and the monotonous sound of Byron's voice. Beyond the desk, Hightower sits erect. Between his parallel and downturned palms and with his lower body concealed by the desk, his attitude is that of an Eastern idol.
It was yesterday morning. There was a countryman coming to town in a wagon with his family. He was the one that found the fire. No, he was the second one to get there, because he told how there was already one fella there when he broke down the door. He told about how he come into sight of the house, and he said to his wife how it was a right smart of smoke coming out of that kitchen, and about how the wagon come on, and then his wife said, that house is afire. And I reckon maybe he stopped the wagon, and they sat there in the wagon for a while, looking at the smoke. And I reckon that after a while he said, it looks like it is. And I reckon it was his wife that made him get down and go and see. They don't know it's a fire, she said, I reckon. You go up there and tell them. And he got out of the wagon and went up onto the porch and stood there, hollering, hello, hello, for a while. He told how he could hear the fire then, inside the house. And then he hit the door a lick with his shoulder and went in, and then he found the one that had found that fire first. It was Brown. But the countryman didn't know that. He just said it was a drunk man in the hall that looked like he had just finished falling down the stairs, and the countryman said, your house is afire, mister, before he realized how drunk the man was. And he told how the drunk man kept on saying how there wasn't nobody upstairs, and that the upstairs was all afire anyway, and there wasn't any use trying to save anything from up there. But the countryman knew there couldn't be that much fire upstairs because the fire was all back toward the kitchen. And besides, the man was too drunk to know anyway. And he told how he suspected there was something wrong from the way the drunk man was trying to keep him from going upstairs. So he started upstairs, and the drunk fella trying to hold him back, and he shoved the drunk man away and went on up the stairs. He told how the drunk man tried to follow him, still telling him how it wasn't anything upstairs, and he said that when he come back down again and thought about the drunk fella, he was gone. But I reckon it was some time before he remembered to think about Brown again, because he went on up the stairs and begun hollering again, opening the doors, and then he opened the right door, and he found her. He ceases. Then there is no sound in the room save the insects. Beyond the open window, the steady insects pulse and beat, drowsy and myriad. Found her, Hightower says. It was Miss Burden he found. He does not move. Byron does not look at him. He might be contemplating his hands upon his lap while he talks. She was lying on the floor. Her head had been cut pretty near off. A lady with the beginning of gray hair.
The man said how he stood there and he could hear the fire and there was smoke in the room itself now, like it had done followed him in. And how he was afraid to try to pick her up and carry her out because her head might come clean off. And then he said how he run back down the stairs again and out the front without even noticing that the drunk fellow was gone, and down to the road and told his wife to whip the team on to the nearest telephone and call for the sheriff, too. And how he run back around the house to the cistern, and he said he was already drawing up a bucket of water before he realized how foolish that was, with the whole back end of the house afire good now. So he run back into the house and up the stairs again and into the room and jerked a cover off the bed and rolled her onto it and caught up the corners and swung it onto his back like a sack of meal and carried it out of the house and laid it down under a tree. And he said that what he was scared of happened because the cover fell open and she was laying on her side, facing one way, and her head was turned clean around like she was looking behind her. And he said how if she could just have done that when she was alive, she might not have been doing it now. Byron ceases and looks, glances once at the man beyond the desk. Hightower has not moved. His face about the twin blank glares of the spectacles is sweating quietly and steadily. And the sheriff come out, and the fire department come too. But there wasn't nothing it could do because there wasn't any water for the hose. And that old house burned all evening, and I could see the smoke from the mill, and I showed it to her when she come up, because I didn't know then. And they brought Miss Burden to town, and there was a paper at the bank that she had told them would tell what to do with her when she died. It said how she had a nephew in the north where she come from. Her folks come from. And they telegraphed the nephew, and in 2 hours they got the answer that the nephew would pay $1,000 reward for who done it. And Christmas and Brown were both gone. The sheriff found out how somebody had been living in that cabin, and then right off everybody begun to tell about Christmas and Brown that had kept it a secret long enough for one of them or maybe both of them to murder that lady. But nobody could find either one of them until last night. The countryman didn't know it was Brown that he found drunk in the house. Folks thought that him and Christmas had both run, maybe. And then last night, Brown showed up. He was sober then, and he come onto the square about 8 o'clock, wild, yelling about how it was Christmas that killed her and making his claim on that $1,000. They got the officers and took him to the sheriff's office, and they told him the reward would be his all right soon as he caught Christmas and proved he done it. And so Brown told. He told about how Christmas had been living with Miss Burden like man and wife for 3 years, until Brown and him teamed up. At first, when he moved out to live in the cabin with Christmas, Brown said that Christmas told him he had been sleeping in the cabin all the time. Then he said how one night he hadn't gone to sleep, and he told how he heard Christmas get up out of bed and come and stand over Brown's cot for a while, like he was listening. And then he tiptoed to the door and opened it quiet and went out. And Brown said how he got up and followed Christmas and saw him go up to the big house and go in the back door, like either it was left open for him or he had a key to it. Then Brown come on back to the cabin and got into bed. But he said how he couldn't go to sleep for laughing, thinking about how smart Christmas thought he was. And he was laying there when Christmas come back in about an hour. Then he said how he couldn't keep from laughing no longer, and he says to Christmas, "You old son of a gun." Then he said how Christmas got right still in the dark, and how he laid there laughing, telling Christmas how he wasn't such a slick one after all, and joking Christmas about gray hair and about how if Christmas wanted him to, he would take it week about with him paying the house rent. Then he told how he found out that night that sooner or later Christmas was going to kill her or somebody. He said he was laying there laughing, thinking that Christmas would just maybe get back in bed again when Christmas struck a match. Then Brown said he quit laughing, and he laid there and watched Christmas light the lantern and set it on the box by Brown's cot. Then Brown said how he wasn't laughing, and he lay there, and Christmas standing there by the cot looking down at him. "Now you got a good joke," Christmas says. "You can get a good laugh telling them in the barber shop tomorrow night." And Brown said he didn't know that Christmas was mad and that he kind of said something back to Christmas.